Thank you. All lines are now bridged.
Good afternoon or good morning, everyone. Welcome to the TEFCA Task Force. We'll get started with a roll call. John Kansky.
I'm here.
Erin Malik. Carolyn Peterson. I believe she's joining. Erin Murray. Cheryl.
Here.
Hi, Cheryl. Was that Erin as well? Okay. Sasha Thurmont.
Here.
Steve Reedy. Cynthia Fisher.
Present.
Neil Jane. Mark Roche. Andy Truscott. Denise Webb.
Here.
David McCallie.
Here.
Mark Savage.
Good morning.
Noel Art.
I'm here.
Grace Terrell. And Laura Kahn.
Here.
Okay. John, I tell you.
Thanks, and welcome again. We are picking up where we left off from Tuesday, and we're going through the draft transmittal letter with the recommendations. For those who were not on the call last time, I don't know if there is anyone in that category, we're picking up with individual access services, which is 4.1. A little bit of explanation of where we are in terms of process is there was a request for We've made edits to the document based on the feedback we got on the call on Tuesday to everything prior to 4.1 in this document. We're optimistic that we're going to get to the end of this document today, and we'll turn another round of edits to get to the bottom of the document and get that out by the weekend, including a clean and redlined version for depending on your preference for those that want to see how it was edited, and then we'll be looking for you to read that and be ready to feedback on our next call. Does that anybody willing to tell me that that made sense of what I just said?
That made sense.
Yep.
Okay.
Yep.
Thank you. I need validation sometimes.
Yep.
So just a reminder that our next call is actually going to be our presentation of the draft recommendations to the committee. So I think it stands to reason these will definitely be draft. We're going to have to do more discussion afterwards. So I think we have four calls right now scheduled between 19th and July 11th, and we can always add on more if we feel necessary.
So, Zoe, consistent with the rules, are we going to go into that high-tech meeting presentation with the draft as it exists after that last round of edits? And what I mean by that is what opportunity, if any, is there to take feedback from the task force and make edits between then and the high-tech meeting?
Yeah, so, okay, so I'm going to Lauren – and Cassandra, if you're on, I'm going to ask you guys to jump in here a little bit. What I think is we can probably make edits based on feedback we get from the task force Monday and Tuesday. When do we need to send in the draft letter to the full committee prior to Wednesday's call? And, like, how baked does the letter have to be? Can it have placeholders and, you know, highlights and red lines? Or should it, you know, be as close to clean as it can be?
So this is Lauren. I think we're shooting to get everything to the full committee by Monday. We do want to give them at least a couple of days to review everything ahead of the meeting. It doesn't have to be completely baked. I think if you want to or need to leave your red line edits in there, you can. But as clean as possible so they get a sense of where the recommendations are. But I would say same morning at the latest.
Does the committee get the document that we've been editing over, or do they get it put into a PowerPoint? Can you just remind us?
So it will be both. The PowerPoint is mostly for the public and for the Adobe display, but we typically send the actual document. Again, it doesn't have to be completely final.
So what I heard is that it will go out over the weekend. If there are any ambitious task force members who want to read and send suggested edits, how would they do that over the weekend?
So,
or should we not put that on the table?
I think the latest we can get everything out is Tuesday morning. So if you want to iterate over the weekend, I'd say that's fine, but we'd have to wrap it up by like end of day Monday.
Yeah, no, I'm not trying to push your timeline. Let me start that over. It sounds like whatever draft we have after the round of edits after this call will be the draft that we're going into the high-tech presentation with, because it'll be sent out Monday. Just my preference or my suggestion would be that I'd rather say that we're still editing and this isn't final than it is to make people read through red lines on the PowerPoint. So the extent, just as a high-tech member and trying to follow the work of other task forces that I'm not on, I'd prefer to be reading something as clean as possible, even if there's a big red thing at the bottom that says this isn't final.
Yeah, John, I think that's perfectly fine.
Okay, thank you.
And the whole point of presenting it to the task force is to get additional feedback for us to take into consideration, right? So we want them to think of it as a draft that seeks their input in the discussion.
That is my understanding as well.
Yeah.
John, quick question. Do you want any time on today's agenda to discuss priorities for the presentation, since we're not meeting again before you're actually making it? Or just do it yourself? Different task forces, in my experience, have approached that question differently.
I'm not sure I've either A, understand the question, or B, have given it any thought, because going into this, I'm going to be happy to clearly explain our work and our recommendations. So can you clarify what you mean by priority?
In the past, we've sometimes picked issues to, instead of just going through something from A to Z, we've sometimes said, here are the most important things for you to focus on. Now we're going to go A to Z. That's been a task force discussion ahead of time just to help the presenters if they had any questions. I don't see time for that on today's agenda. That's why I was asking the question.
I'll admit we hadn't planned for that.
We did identify a prioritization. I think, you know, that our discussions have been gated by that list that you and Arian put together early on. Maybe you could share that just as a backdrop of where we focused our energies.
Good point. That's probably where the presentation will start, is to, with that framing before we dive into, recommendations. I would offer that if we're extremely lucky and we have an extra 5 or 10 minutes at the end, was that Mark's suggestion or question?
That was Mark, yes.
Yeah. I'm learning voices. if we have a few minutes at the end and you feel strongly about some aspects of priority, we'll try and take that on at the end. And if we don't get to that, we'll lean on the approach that David just suggested.
Okay. If we do have time at the end, it'll help me if somebody can throw up whatever that prioritization was, because it's not committed to my short-term memory.
Yeah, same here. It was more of a framing of the charge,
yep.
I think, if I'm remembering correctly. Okay. Let's dive in, because the sooner we work through these recommendations, the more likely it is we'll have time for to prepare for the high-tech presentation. Okay, we left off on individual access services, and by the way, disclaimer and apology in advance is that I'm slightly less prepared today than I have been for previous calls, so I may end up having to read these to you to get them back in my RAM as well. This one is focused on, I think, recommendation 7A and alternative recommendation represent slightly different points of view, and I think we want to have a discussion, focused discussion, to find out if there's consensus among the group. Recommendation 7, and I again, tell me if I'm wrong, I think, Mark, you may have been championing this on a prior call. I may impose on you to speak to this after framing. So the observation was that individual access services, as defined in draft TEFCA, have a certain constrained focus, and that ONC should consider building a broader set of capabilities for individuals, not just limited to accessing a copy of their EHI. An alternative recommendation was that we are suggesting ONC should walk first, then run, suggesting that the capability of IAS in TEFCA is already a huge step forward. If ONC adds rights capabilities into TEFCA, they would also need to include in the rule. Okay, so I think it's, if I'm not misinterpreting, it's two alternative points of view. One, that the IAS in draft TEFCA isn't broad enough, and the other is that it's fine, don't put any more in there right now. With that, where do we stand? Carolyn Peterson is fastest to the draw.
David here.
Okay, David, you're after Carolyn.
Hey.
Oh, okay. I didn't hear you. Go ahead. I'm sorry. I just lost the sound for a second there. Go ahead, Carolyn.
Yeah, I just wanted to express my support for Recommendation 7A. I think that the broader approach is important because certainly this is something that consumers are starting to do and have demonstrated an interest in. It may be very important for patients to be able to have this capability as more mobile health apps are built out and there is greater reliance on patient-reported outcomes and other interactive measures. I think saying we don't need to worry about this just kicks the can down the road and creates a problem in a few years where we have technology that doesn't support the capabilities that providers and patients want to use.
Thank you. David?
So I'll take a compromise point of view. I don't think these need to be alternatives. I think you could say basically start first with the described read capabilities that leverage existing networks and then incrementally advance from there. Don't limit yourself to read. ONC should not limit the TEF to read access, but you should start there. The technical complexity to add federated write access to directly to clinical data repositories, electronic health records, is a gigantic technical step of complexity, risk, security, et cetera. And it would be, I think, ill-advised to start with that as an immediate goal, start with the goal that's currently expressed, and then incrementally advance. So I'm in favor of mentioning the expansion to write capability, but I think 7B is a starting point. So I would just merge those two into a single thought, I think.
Thank you. Noam has his hand raised.
Yeah, just real quick. I actually support what David's saying. To me, 7B provides the answer to the when of expanding 7A, right? So if 7A doesn't say sort of when that capacity should be broader, 7B sort of says, well, you do read first and then you worry about other capabilities. So I would also support sort of munging them together.
Thank you. Mark, and then Denise.
So I think we should keep, there's two issues here and they are in some ways connected, but in other ways separate. The read-write is a question, but expanding individual access services beyond merely exercising two rights under the HIPAA privacy rule doesn't depend on whether you've got right access or not. You can, that is, and so I would disconnect those two in people's thinking. I think there's, whatever we say on read and write, I think we also should expand individual access services beyond just getting a copy under 524 or directing under section 164 or 524 and or directing that a copy be transmitted to a third party.
Could you, Mark, what do you have in your mind's eye just to help me understand the use case?
So previous ones that do involve writing things like PGHD, patient-reported outcomes, but imagine the kinds of things that people are already trying to do on their portal around lab results, prescriptions, contacting their doctor, shared care planning in its current nascent forms. There's a third HIPAA right actually that if we're just focused on rights, it definitely should be in there, which is the right to correct or amend your record when there's errors or omissions. Those are all things that should be a part of, those are core use cases. That's not the stuff around the periphery that I think should be a part of individual access services. So I wouldn't even be defining it around exercising these rights under HIPAA.
So,
my concern
several...
would be whether...
Go ahead, David.
Sorry. Well, just my, you know, I think those are laudable goals. I'm not sure that TEF is a framework to achieve them. The complexity to do so compared to doing it with consumers directly interacting with the people that are helping manage their care is not necessarily worth the risks, would seem to me. That's something that should be carefully thought out.
So we got a lot of people wanting to weigh in on this one. I'm going to put myself in line behind Denise, Cynthia, and Carolyn. So Denise, you're up.
So I see Mark's points on this about the differentiation, the two issues of read-write versus read versus the particular use cases that individual access services is limited to or expanded to. But I generally think that these issues all need to be combined and addressed in one recommendation, and that that there should not be a cap or a limit on the individual access services exchange purpose, that we should start with a place that's achievable but not limit what potential there is.
So I understand that comment to be somewhat consistent with the walk first, then run, sort of what Noam was saying a few minutes ago.
Yes.
And I think I feel maybe an edit to this recommendation emerging as advising ONC that there's lots of other things individuals are going to want and need to do, but some understanding that they can't all be put be done immediately within the first implementation of TEF.
Yeah,
Cynthia.
That's a good.
I'm sorry. Go ahead. Thank you.
I was just gonna say that, you know, whether it's read or write, I mean, it depends on the use case, and you know, we shouldn't restrict things to just being read.
Got it. And again, I'm going to respect those with their hands raised and not offer my opinion until we get through. Cynthia and then Carolyn.
Yes. Hi. I support what Mark was bringing up and Denise also, that it really needs to be read-write access for the patients. And, you know, this is really about delivering patient individual access to their data, and I think to be restrictive based upon limited capabilities of today's software is also a problem. And I think it needing to open it up that even in patients wanting access to open notes, for instance, and being able to correct those notes where they're erroneous, and then also being able to share it to a third party. These things are going to be eminently important in allowing for fluidity and also across systems. And also, I think we have to be really cognizant of how disruptive innovation can be to allow for superior convenience, efficiency, and reduced cost to the individual. So by them getting the highest level of access and fluidity across systems and read-write ability for correcting errors, having that access is going to be really, really important. You know, I think just in this week's Boston Globe, there was a report on the hospital error rates and misdiagnoses and error rates in the hospitals of the Massachusetts, and we saw nearly 20%. If we can prevent that and bring that number down through patient engagement and actively engaged into their data and to their results, that's a critical important factor to improve healthcare and also reduce price. Thanks.
Thank you. And a key question for me, which I think I'm gonna, I don't keep, there's three people with their hands raised, so let me just kind of parking lot this one, but a question I have for Mark, Carol, and Cynthia, who seem to be in the same camp, is are you insisting or strongly, are you feeling strong that this broader capability for individual access services needs to be defined in the exchange purpose that's required from day one? And Carolyn is next up with her hand raised, not to put you on the spot.
You know, as you ask the question that way and frame it that way, given that you're looking for an either or yes or no answer, I'd have to say yes. I appreciate that there are technical difficulties with all of this, and it's hard, and it costs money. But if we don't think broadly and look down the road to the future, to all of the things that the system currently expects patients and providers to do, and will expect them to do more and more going forward, we will always be in this position of the technology not keeping up with the needs, waste, safety issues, problems that never get solved because we're not looking far enough down the road. I'd say, yeah, it needs to be in the broad from the beginning. Thank you.
So defining a phased, and I'm arbitrarily going to say three phases of first this, then that, and building that into the path of TEFCA wouldn't address your concern that it would be forgotten?
Well, that depends on what the language is. If you have very vague language that says when we've achieved X, then we'll think about Y, then you are left with forever arguing about whether we've achieved X and what X actually was and what anybody agreed to in the first place, and you never get down the road. So I'm happy to look at the language and to try to help craft something that I think addresses where Cynthia and Mark and I and perhaps others are looking. But we need to be careful about what we're actually saying and make sure we're saying something.
Thank you. David and Aaron are waiting patiently, so I'm going to withhold interjecting my opinion. David, keep going.
Yeah, I got a million things I could react to, but I want to zoom out a tiny bit, and maybe it's a Zoe question, which is, over time, how does TEF change the permitted purposes and use cases? Does it require new rulemaking? Is that something that can be delegated to the RCE? Is there an RCE-ONC back channel path that will allow for expansion of use cases? In other words, we're talking about essentially adding a new use case here. That could happen now in the recommendations that we're making, or it could happen a year from now if we talk about the go slow, do it later approach. But either way, it's expanding the current list of I'm calling them use cases because I think it's a mix of permitted purpose and modality. So the question, in a wordy way, is how do those things get expanded over time? Does that require new rulemaking, or is that built into the TEF definition?
So we do anticipate that these things will be, the use cases will be expanded over time, and that the RCE will be responsible for figuring out a process for how to do that and how to kind of come to consensus along with the industry that a use case is ready for, you know, widespread adoption and can be adopted into the TEFCA. It would require a new version of the common agreement. So just to differentiate between rulemaking, this is not a rule. Ideally we would be able to update the common agreement a little bit faster without having to go through the entire rulemaking process, but it would still require an update to the agreement. And then we've said that anytime there is an update to the common agreement, that participating entities would have 18 months to implement those updates. So if there is a process also that we want to recommend to the RCE for how to determine whether a new use case is ready for adoption, that would be something that we could consider in the recommendation as well.
Yeah, I think the fact that that's how you anticipate it working is worth calling out, because it means that we're not fixed in stone with the list of use cases on day one with cohort one. So regardless of how we land on the wording of recommendation 7A and B, it's probably worth calling out that this is not a static set of capabilities. It can be expanded. I'll make my second point, which is, remember, this is a voluntary network, so you have to convince the stakeholders that it's worth doing. With stuff that they already are comfortable doing.
Yeah, and Aaron is next in line, but Aaron, I'm going to sneak in a quick point on. I think, David, I think of TEFCA as a big basket that we're going to ask the industry to voluntarily pick up, and the more we put in that basket, the heavier it's going to be. And with undeniable that we want individuals to have more and better access and better capabilities, I'm concerned about how big this brick is that we're suggesting putting in the basket. So Aaron, you're up.
Thanks. All right, so two things. Number one, I think, you know, as an industry CIO, I still remember the large push to get portal adoption, and then we dropped it from a threshold of 20% down to one patient being able to leverage a patient portal. I think back to the view, download, transmit requirements that were eventually whittled back. I am in agreement that up front, we do need to state up front more capabilities beyond just walk and run. We need to be able to write, and users should have the ability, patients should have the ability to write into TEFCA and request things. If for nothing else, for privacy requests such as Title 10 and other things people need to consider and think about, how else will a patient notify respective nodes in the network to remove their information and such forth? So for me, I don't think that we should restrict ourselves because it's more difficult, and I understand the concern about the brick being too big to lift. However, I think we're doing ourselves a disservice and the industry a disservice if we don't upfront state that.
Thank you. Mark has his hand raised.
And just an observation that this came up for me because we have all these exchange purposes: treatment, benefits determination, quality, public health. Individual access services was the one that was actually limited to those two things. There aren't limits on the other exchange purposes that I've discovered so far. So I don't actually feel like we're trying to add big use cases in. The thing that has been done differently for individual access is to actually put a bottleneck around it.
So, I think I'm detecting that we may have a minority and a majority recommendation here. I'm trying to fathom how a individual, what are they writing to? Because if you're asking so I'm just offering an example of where my head's going in terms of technologically, if we add a broader set of capabilities around individual access services, then giving the patient the opportunity to get their healthcare information via individual access services, we're broadening those to capabilities that include write. I'm not sure, are they writing to every EHR and every participant member across every participant across every QHIN, or what are they writing to?
But the more importantly is, can they write? Let's don't worry even more about that. That's what I'm saying is, let them be able to write, and then we can determine what the right vehicle modality is.
Well, but if I can't answer the question, what are we talking about them writing to? I don't know what letting them write means.
Well, I mean, case in point, and I don't want a solution design here on the phone, but I mean, if I'm a patient and I want to restrict my information because of Title 10, for whatever reason, I should be able to send out some sort of broadcast message to everybody saying, please remove my records for Title 10 purposes, whatnot, and that's noted so that folks can comply with that from a Title 10 perspective and show that they're meeting that requirement just for that item, right? So, again, we could solution design all day, but at some point, you got to be able to write back.
And we're going to talk about meaningful choice in a minute, and I know what you just said goes beyond that, but I think it's in the context of I don't know that I need to ask ONC to comment, but invite them to. The idea behind meaningful choice was to give individuals the opportunity to express that restriction and have it communicated across TEFCA ecosystem.
Awesome. Okay.
Okay, a bunch of people with their hands in line. Mark, David, Cynthia, Noam. So please keep your comments as pointed as possible.
So you may still have my hand up, but I do have an answer to your question, and I would suggest start with the simplest one that's been around for 20 years, which is you want to make a correction or amendment to your record. That's in the HIPAA privacy rule. That would be an example of right that's been around.
Thank you. David?
I like enumerating some of these goals as, you know, four examples, but defer to the RCE to come up with a technical scheme that's actually feasible. And I'll make the analogy, dangerous sometimes to make analogies, but in, you know, banking and personal finance, there are nice services like Mint and others that allow you to create an aggregated, very detailed view into your financial situation. But those services almost never, and maybe never, allow you to directly perform transactions against the native participants and against the bank or the financial exchange. You go through their process to do that. And I don't think healthcare data is any less sensitive than financial data. So this is a really big step to go from aggregating a view of your record, aggregating all of the data in your record, which is the current state of the proposal, to one where you can go and modify data at each of the nodes on the network. It's aspirational, yes. It's practically extremely difficult. So listed as an aspirational goal, and let people figure it out, as APIs proliferate, it may get easier to do this, but you have to deal with patient identity in a way that's much stronger than our current model. You have to deal with the fact that your record is spread and copied over and over again. If you make a correction, how do those corrections propagate all across the network? You know, it just gets really complicated. I can't imagine doing it, actually. But that doesn't mean you shouldn't list it. I agree. List them.
And I guess this is a comment and a question. The HIPAA right is to request a correction to your record, not to correct your record. Is that legally accurate?
This is Mark.
That's how I understand.
Yes, that's right. You don't actually write into the correction indirectly into the record. It's moderated by the provider.
You're asking to give the individual the right to submit that request for correction, not make a correction.
In that particular instance, that's the usual form. We've done some at UCSF. We've done some interviewing of people using Write APIs, and there's different models. So sometimes there's Write directly into the record. Sometimes you're actually writing into a separate data warehouse, and then somebody else is making a decision about what to incorporate from the data warehouse into the electronic health record. I know we're not solving those kinds of things. I'm just in this task force, but to illustrate, there's different ways of doing this. Some of them may raise fears and others may not.
Okay, thank you. And I'll admit, it's a bit of a mind blower for me to, I'm kind of with David on thinking about how that would happen, but that what you just said helped me. Cynthia and then Noam, and then I think we go on.
Oh, it's just that I'm in favor of listing some of these goals. I'm not opposed. I don't get me wrong. I think these are great ideas. I just want to respect the fact that they may be awfully heavy bricks to start with. That's my main concern.
That's where I'm at. Good ideas. Worried about putting them in the basket initially.
Yeah.
Okay. Noam, and then we need to move on, I think.
This is Cynthia. I was in there.
No, there was someone ahead of me.
I'm sorry. You were right, Cynthia, and then Noam.
Thank you. I go back to what Aaron was saying earlier, with Mark and Caroline and I, with really empowerment of, the whole CARES Act, TESCA, this whole enterprise and all this work is really to empower the patient with their information. And I just want to make sure that we're not looking to solve how the coding is done or what the design is today, but the reality is there are so many amazing APIs out there that exist in other ways in management that can be flipped to be utilized in the healthcare arena as well. And I just think that we have to not be paternalistic here to the individual and the individual's right to access. And, we are in a moment in time where the technology, the data, and the design is out there to empower the consumer to have a two-way read-write ability to do significant one correction where it's feasible. And we're not talking about banking because we're not talking about the financial part and changing numbers. We're actually allowing the patient, who is the best person, the most knowledgeable person of their actual health, and they really have to have a role of empowerment on the accuracy of managing their own health care. So I think they're a very missing player at this table, and I just would support what some of the others have said about really putting it in there as our objective, and the design will happen. So I think it's our role to open the pipes and make it happen.
Thank you. Noam, and then we'll move on to recommendation 8.
Yeah, just real quick. There was a comment a bit earlier, that this is the only exchange purpose that seems to have some kind of throttle on its capability. But to me, it's the modalities that really define what you can actually do within the exchange purposes. And frankly, it's the modalities that constrain all of them, right? We have two query modalities, they're not going to help a patient write anything, and a message delivery modality, that might help a patient submit a correction. But to me, those are really the throttling effects, and they throttle all of the exchange purposes. Because if there isn't a modality to do something you conceive of doing, you can't do it, right?
Thank you.
Are the modalities limited? This is Zoe's question.
The modalities, say what they are, right? It's targeted query, broadcast query, message delivery. And the first
but
say this is about, essentially receiving EHI. The third one says this is about pushing EHI and not receiving it.
Yeah, I think David's trying to ask a question about the latitude.
Yeah, it's the same question I asked about the use cases before to Zoe, and my understanding based on that her former answer, her current answer, prior answer, is that the RCE could expand on those things, including modalities. But maybe I got that wrong.
Not sure.
Sure, that could expand on anything, but you know, we have to decide what we want to comment on, right? But the point is, we can't push about patient writing unless we address the modality that would support that, right? We can't make recommendations overall that are inconsistent with each other. So if there isn't a modality, as I'll say it this way, if there isn't a modality to support patient, you know, rights, then to me that's a structural problem with our recommendations.
Yeah, I have to give that some thought, because my assumption, without thinking about individual access services, but thinking about the other modalities, is if whether I query for some information or whether I am pushed some information, I can incorporate that in my system, in the appropriate patient record, et cetera. So I ultimately am writing to the system based on the information I got back from a query or information that was pushed to me. So I have to think about your point.
Right, but would you be expected to query a patient?
Well, that's where you made the point that perhaps the patients could, to accomplish this capability that you're suggesting, would use the messaging modality. Again, I have to think about it, but that's kind of, it's an unsolicited, here's something you need to know. We have a ton of feedback. Clearly, we'll have a dramatically different version of recommendation 7, whether that ends up being a primary and possibly minority view, or whether we just note that we have some more work to do. Related, I'm going to take us to recommendation 8, which I think is perhaps a NOAM memorial recommendation, and I have a question that goes along with it. Public health authorities as defined under HIPAA shouldn't be required to respond to individual access services. And initially my comment, giving myself the opportunity to go first here, was initially, hey, yeah, that seems to make sense to me. And then I thought, well, wait a minute, what about, are there any exceptions to that? Like, let me explain myself. Exceptions like immunization registries. Wow, it just sure seems like an individual might want to be able to query their record from a public health information registry. What also seems true, knowing what I know about public health and the capabilities of, for example, local health departments technologically, which is in some cases almost none, is that we shouldn't require them to be able to produce anything they have, as we're requiring of other actors in this equation, because I just think they can't, and I don't want my tax dollars to be allocated to creating that burden on local health departments. So my comment would be, sounds like it makes sense. There might be some exceptions like immunization registry. I must have said something to tweak curiosity, because I've got 4 people in line. But Noam, did you want to comment? I'll give you a first try.
I think the key word there is required. So there is some concern that public health collects clinical data through its public health function under HIPAA and under state and local law, isn't typically funded and doesn't typically have a mandate to provide any of that data back. It doesn't mean it doesn't or couldn't, and you're right, immunization registries, where they're funded and where they're legally permitted, do in fact provide data back. But data from electronic lab reporting is typically never provided back to the patient, in part because identifying the patient can be sometimes problematic. So for me, I mean, I certainly support this recommendation, and the key word there is required. So public health folks are concerned that they're going to get sort of caught up in this TEFCA thing and be required to respond to a patient's request or desire.
And as written, I believe that's accurate that they would be required. ONC, is that correct?
Well, I'm not actually so sure about that because there's this notion of direct relationship. So if an immunization registry, even one that's capable of responding to a patient query, doesn't establish a direct relationship with the patient, it's not clear to me they actually would be required.
So, okay, so let's explore that so we're starting from the right place because here's my understanding is that no, public health is not required to enable individuals to come to them and say, I want to establish a direct relationship. But if somewhere in the TEFCA ecosystem, the individual establishes a direct relationship and then queries for their information, if that local or county or state health department is in the TEFCA ecosystem as a participant or participant member, they would be required to respond. And I'm asking ONC if that interpretation is correct.
So I think that NOM has pointed out a discrepancy in the way it's currently drafted. So I do think the intention is that everybody would have to respond to individual access services queries, but he is correct that the language also does say with a direct relationship. So I think if the task force could help with a recommendation on that discrepancy, that would be really helpful.
So I'm not sure I...
Recommendation 8 should stand. just say no.
So, and we're going to get to the folks in line here in a second. I'm not sure I understood your answer, Zoe. So, if I'm an individual, well, I'm an individual, and so I declare a direct relationship with someone in the TEFCA ecosystem who's a participant, and I request my information from a state health department or local health department that's a participant, whether they're on another QHIN or not, where's the ambiguity or where's the discrepancy? The draft says that they would currently have to respond to that even if that patient didn't have a direct relationship with them. Is that wrong?
Find it. So I think in...
While she's looking, I don't think any one party can declare unilaterally a direct relationship, right? That's a mutual thing. So one answer would say, well, public health just doesn't establish direct relationships. It just says, no, you know, I know patients. You can't establish a direct relationship with me, right? It's a bilateral thing, isn't it?
Okay, well, this gets to the definition of direct relationship, and it's important in this conversation that we have a clear understanding. Here's how I understand it. If there's an individual that wants to participate in TEFCA, they can go to a QHIN, a participant, or a participant member that offers individual access services, and they can say, I want my direct relationship to be with you. They have chosen their on-ramp for the TEFCA ecosystem. But if you're in the TEFCA ecosystem somewhere else, in another state, in another place, under another QHIN, you're still in the TEFCA ecosystem. And when an individual makes a request for information, you have a duty to respond. And I'm asking if that's wrong, because that's my understanding. Thank you.
But look at that definition on the screen. It says that the participant has to offer the services.
Correct.
So if a public health registry simply, so the question is, what does offer the services mean?
Okay, so your assumption is that, your assumption, Noam, is, and I'm not saying mine is correct, I'm trying to clarify, is your assumption is that if I want information from a participant member, or QHIN, I have to have a direct relationship with them, and therefore, as an individual, I would have to declare a direct relationship with anybody in TEFCA that I wanted their information from. And I'm assuming that I only, as an individual, I only need to declare a direct relationship with anybody who's in TEFCA, and they'll be my on-ramp to the rest of the ecosystem.
Okay, I see the difference, but you still have to, but the ultimate source of the information still has to offer the service.
And that's the point that I didn't think, I thought that was clear, is that, so when we say that these are the exchange purposes in TEFCA, and we're saying that QHINs need to be able to do all of them, and any participant that signs on with them needs to be able to do all of them, and any participant member that signs on needs to be able to do all of them. So when that local health department chooses to participate in TEFCA as drafted, they're basically saying, yes, we will respond to individual access services as well as the other exchange purposes.
I think the problem is that it's, I believe, at least my interpretation is that it's drafted both ways. Which is why I think I appreciate you guys pointing out this discrepancy, because in the 2.2.1 section, it does say, the way John just said, that everybody has to respond to all requests for individual access services, but then in the individual access services language, it specifies the direct relationship.
But you could argue, I think, that public health, you have a direct relationship if you're in the public covered by a particular public health entity. It's not a choice kind of relationship. It's mandated by your local laws.
But
you
this
do
is
have
a capital,
direct relationship.
But this is capital D, capital R direct relationship as defined in TEFCA. It's something an individual has to declare.
But I think it needs to be broadened to include those relationships that are implicit by other laws like public health. You don't have a choice about whether your provider submits your registry, your immunization data to a registry.
Oh, yes,
it's
you do.
It's required by law. It's required by law in most settings, right? And you can't withhold it.
Nope. It's required by law in some states.
In some states, okay, so I'm just saying.
By law in many states, and there are opt-out provisions in many states.
Okay,
so if you've opted out and you don't have your data in the registry, then the query will return nothing because it's not there. So if it's there, it's there because you either allowed it to be there or your state required it to be there. So you have a relationship to public health based on whether public health has your data.
Who's trying to get in, please?
It's Denise. I have my hand raised.
Very patient, and Mark as well.
So I have some background from having worked in public health, and as I'm listening to this conversation, so first of all, most data that we received in public health, we were not the source of the data. We received the data from providers that do have a direct relationship with a patient. And so patients can get their information from those entities they have a direct relationship with, such as their providers. Does public health provide information to patients? Yes, they may, like with an immunization registry, which you can query and get your information in some states. The other point I wanted to make is that there are situations where public health does have a direct relationship from a care perspective with patients, such as through a public health nurse, or if you go to a public health department to receive your immunization, you know, if they run an immunization clinic or if they run some other sort of clinic, which some public health departments do. And then they would be the source, the original source of the information. So, you know, I really do think we need a recommendation here stating that public health authorities are not required. They may, but they're not required to respond to IAS unless they provide direct patient care and hold that patient's information, that they're the source of the information and they participate in the TEF ecosystem.
if public health agencies provide services like any other clinical site, I believe that looking at recommendation 8, they're then a hybrid entity, and they're not functioning in their public health role in that clinical service role. So I accept what
they're
you
more
say.
Like a covered entity.
Right. And that's what a hybrid entity is. So I think so. So I would support what Denise said. I'm not even sure that the second half is necessary to say, because that's already the public health agency not functioning as a public health agency, but functioning as a regular clinical site.
Comment? Are you going to go through the hands?
Sure. Mark is next.
That was, I like that, sure. Denise, I think, picked up on one of the questions I wanted to raise, which is, I don't know the definitions in HIPAA, but I am aware that public health is sometimes providing individual care to individuals, treatment to individuals, and I don't know if that's called public health and for purposes of HIPAA or otherwise, but it seems to be a situation that we need to figure out the answer for that, whether they have to or not under the current draft. And if not, then we should be making a recommendation that allows individuals to get their information from them. I also want to support the notion that there may be registry data that where individuals ought to be able to get the information too. And I know from nationwide consumer surveys, including one that I oversaw, that immunizations is a huge deal. And if it requires saying an exception for immunizations, that's definitely worth considering, because it affects all the people who are trying to get their kids into school and summer camps and all that kind of thing and have to fill out the forms. It is a huge use case. And there are others, but just to affirm the notion that immunizations needs to be looked at.
So thinking about the fact that this recommendation is going to go in front of HITACH next week, I would offer to whoever's taking notes that the recommendation needs to include three things. One, kind of what it says now as drafted, plus two, except when acting as a provider as defined by HIPAA, and number three, there's four of them. Three is we probably need to discuss an exception for immunization registries. And then four is that we need to ask ONC to clarify the NOAM interpretation, John interpretation, because there's ambiguity about whether all providers and, I'm sorry, participants and participant members are required to respond to individual access service queries or not. And I hope you're a fast typer. Okay, so well, that's getting documented. Moving on to 4.2, which is related to public health, and we have to decide, I guess, ultimately where we're going to put recommendation 8, because it could go either place, but wanted to just have a placeholder. Did we exhaust our public health-specific recommendations with that discussion, or is there anything else, admitting that I'm tempting fate?
I have more that's a broader principle that public health falls under. David.
Sure. David, go ahead.
The success of the current exchange networks like Commonwealth and Care Quality, eHealth Exchange, are based heavily on the notion of reciprocity, which is that if you query others for data, you have to be willing to share data. And I worry about the slippery slope of creating carve-outs where that reciprocity no longer applies, particularly if the carve-out is based on some concern like NOAM's initial concern, public health entities aren't technically equipped to respond. Would we also extend a carve-out to say that small EHR vendors that have limited technical staff don't have to respond, or that skilled nursing facilities that have no IT department don't have to respond?
where do you draw the line of who you carve out of reciprocity? And I think there probably are legitimate places where you would carve out an exception to reciprocity, but they have to be really carefully scoped. And I would say probably that's an RCE function in their enumeration of use cases where they carefully limit the carve-outs to reciprocity. Just because you're small, an entity, and can't afford to do it and don't have appropriate funding, I don't think that automatically gives you a right to basically not share patient data that you have. You have to deal with that problem.
I think I would actually offer my opinion. I'd second that line of thinking. With that, are there any? Can we move on to privacy and meaningful choice, or are there other comments related to public health? I don't want to force anything. We just wanted to make sure we didn't skip over that.
Hi, this is Laura Khan. I have my hand up. Can you hear me?
Yes, I'm sorry. You absolutely do have your hand up. I apologize.
Okay, no problem. And I'm not sure if it goes here, but I wanted to raise the issue of the issue of fees in the change from TEFCA 1 to TEFCA 2. TEFCA 1 had public health exception for fees, and TEFCA 2 does not. And I think that could be a real issue for public health if public health is going to be required to participate in fees related to queries and push messages. I'm not sure if it goes under this public health specific section or if there's something about the fees somewhere else in the letter.
So Laura, yeah, just to clarify, Zoe, the fees are strictly QHIN to QHIN, so it would be, and there's also no requirement that there are fees. It's based that fees, you know, are put on the QHINs for exchanging. It would be the QHIN who has to, you know, pay the fee to, you know, receive the data. Now, the QHIN could pass that fee down to their participants, but I just wanted to be clear about that.
Zoe, can you say more about why it was changed and why it was in the first one and not the second one?
I mean, we received feedback that we should leave the majority of any policies around fees up to the RCE to develop, aside from the individual access services use case, because I think the policy aim that we had in mind is that individuals have already paid enough into the health system, and so want to ensure that access is as easy as possible for them. But otherwise, many of the public comments asked us to leave that to the rest of the fee schedule to the RCE.
Okay, so the RCE would have the ability to make a statement around public health exchanges that would apply to all QHINs?
That would apply to QHINs, yeah. And then in terms of fees lower down, the RCE could make requirements around the fees that QHINs pay to the RCE, but beyond that, QHINs would be in charge of their own internal fee schedule, so what participant members and participants have to pay to join, if anything.
Okay, thank you.
Hey, Zoe, I'm gonna note, and there are a couple hands raised, but I'm gonna note that it's 6 minutes after one. We eventually have to go to public comment, and we are on recommendation nine, not even on recommendation 9 of 18. So we're clearly not gonna get through this document before the HITECH meeting, and I wanted to pause and note that. And ask if you have any suggestions.
I think meaningful. I think we should try to get through meaningful choice because I think that there was the most discussion around that. And then I guess the only thing to do is you know, really present the remainder of the recommendations either as, you know, we haven't had a chance to follow up on these and, you know, we need to have more discussion. Or, I mean, Lauren, if you think it's okay for us to say we're going to, you know, only going to present our recommendations up to meaningful choice and we're still working on the others.
Yeah, I think that's fine. I think it probably makes sense to present what's final or as close to final as possible. Before moving on beyond meaningful choice recommendations.
Thank you. I just wanted to note that. Okay, so we have Noam and Mark, and then let's make sure we get on to meaningful choice quickly. Noam?
Yeah, just a quick comment. I think there may be some traction behind David's comment about, sort of exceptions or reciprocity. But I just don't want to let it go without again saying that public health is not in control of its own funding usually, and to put mandates on it that it simply cannot fulfill would be a real problem. Immunization registries, very strong use case, very strong will, but if there just isn't the funding to do it, you just can't require public health to do that.
I feel like this is analogous to you're saying don't put a brick in the basket that places this requirement on public health, and I feel like it's analogous to the brick in the basket argument I was making with regard to the rest of the industry. So it's tough. Mark, you put your hand down, is that correct? Okay, so I'm gonna assume silence means okay to move on. So we're on to meaningful choice. So recommendation. Yeah, nice, easy one. So we have three recommendations under this category, and I am going to read these to put these in RAM for myself and everybody else. Recommendation 9, ONC should clarify the policy goals around meaningful choice and leave the granular technical requirements to the RCE. ONC should require the RCE to establish appropriate flow-down terms that require participants and participant members to allow for meaningful choice. Any comments on that? Was the idea behind this recommendation, I'm trying to remember where we left off, was there lack of clarity around when one made a request for meaningful choice, whether that was to trickle through to the whole TEFCA ecosystem, or was that not the basis of this recommendation? Anyone remember?
Well, the technical requirements, the granular technical requirement part, I remember, and that's just basically what it says. The current document is pretty specific about the notion of broadcasting choice decisions, and that might not make a lot of sense as to whether that's a technical means of achieving the policy goal of having choice. But I don't recall the flow-down argument. I don't recall what that was about.
So, David, are you? I'm just asking to try and get the task force all back on the same page. You support the first half of that recommendation. It's not a question of whether the meaningful choice should or shouldn't be communicated across the whole TEF ecosystem. It's a question of whether the RCE should be allowed to specify how it's done versus having it in the QTF, question mark?
Yeah, I'm in agreement with that notion that the technical details should be left to the RCE. I think I now understand that second sentence. I think it's just there must have been some concern that participants could somehow opt out of being required to grant meaningful choice, and they're saying the RCE contract language should require them to grant meaningful choice. And I don't know that that needs to be said, because I think that's already in there, but that makes
so
sense.
Question,
certainly, you shouldn't be able to sidestep it just because you don't want to do it.
Question to ONC, and I apologize if this is, I think we answered this one before. When an individual requests, exercises their meaningful choice, is it currently in the draft specified that that meaningful choice needs to be communicated up through their chain, through their QHIN to the other QHINs and down? Or, it's all coming back to me now. I think what we discussed is it needs to be communicated up to their QHIN and across to the other QHINs, but isn't required to be communicated throughout the whole network. That's my recollection. Anybody from ONC able to tell me that's right?
That's correct. It goes up to the QHIN and then across to the other QHINs, but doesn't need to go all the way down the chain.
So what
would that mean? You could meaningfully opt out of QHIN to QHIN exchange, but that wouldn't affect what the QHIN is doing internally with its participants. Is that, you couldn't opt out of that because it's inside the QHIN?
David, I think that means that let's pretend there's four QHINs. And you're an individual that's under one of them. If you exercise your meaningful choice, then that meaningful choice is going to apply across all participants and participant members of that QHIN. Your QHIN is also going to communicate that to the other QHINs so that they're, I don't know, my clear view of this is breaking down a little bit, but that they'll be aware of it. But that doesn't mean that if you sought care with another participant member under another QHIN, that they wouldn't have that meaningful choice knowledge necessarily. They wouldn't have that meaningful choice knowledge.
Yeah, I think that's what's being said. This is why this is so complicated. What on earth would that mean?
So it sounds like part of this recommendation, or a recommendation 9B, should be our understanding is as described, but that needs to be clarified, and it's a little confusing.
And so maybe the question is clarifying whether meaningful choice only applies to TEF-mediated exchange, or whether it propagates into non-TEF exchange. And it seems pretty clear that it doesn't propagate. Maybe we need to get clarity on that. I guess TEF has no authority anyway, so they can't make it propagate.
My assumption was that by definition, meaningful choice only applied to TEF transactions. Okay.
That makes sense.
This is Mark. Can I just jump in and to say, when we ask for clarification, I don't know that we're going to ever get an opportunity to do anything with the clarification, so we should perhaps put in the request, but also put in the parameters of our thinking, because this is our one opportunity.
Keep going. I'm just trying to understand.
You mean make
the request for clarification as clear as possible.
Yes, but also do our best to say what we think the answer should be, because we don't know that we're going to be asked to come up with round, version 2, version 3 of recommendations. This is a letter that's going to the national coordinator.
I agree that's better. That sounds a lot harder too.
Understood.
So I would suggest that for now, if you want, we can make a note in the draft recommendation that says that we're going to try and give some thought to how it should be, and then circle back to it after the HITAC meeting, without making a commitment that we necessarily can. And I would welcome any thoughts. I think that's a different discussion and debate entirely on the, now that we know what it says, how should it be?
Right. I'm saying this because I'm remembering we've made statements above that just say we need clarification here, we need clarification there. I think this is an observation that applies at each of those points. Not to take any more time right now.
No, fair point. And we will aspire to, whenever possible, my sense is that up to this point, if we think we know how it should be, and we can agree, we've already said that, but we also have some time after the high-tech meeting to add clarity where we can, add suggestions where we can. Okay, number 10 is somewhat easier, I think, to recall. It's ONC should ensure that meaningful choice is not just a check-the-box exercise, but that it provides meaningful information about where and how an individual's EHI will be used and disclosed. I'm going to argue with those words a little bit. I thought the intent of those that brought this up said, if this is buried in process in a way that the individual doesn't really understand it, that's bad. We should make sure that isn't the case. And I'm not sure that that's what the second half of the sentence says. No, I think it does. Sorry, I apologize. To me, it's easy for me to agree with this recommendation, but I feel like kind of the cousin of the question Mark, or the suggestion Mark just made is, so what do we suggest?
Well, doesn't the current draft require the minimum information that you have to communicate around this privacy policy and choice policy? It seems like my memory is that it's already addressed in somewhat specific language.
You might be referring. Yeah, go ahead, Zoe.
Yeah, so minimum information is a different concept, but what we say about meaningful choice is that instructions for how to exercise your meaningful choice need to be included in the written privacy summary that the entity publishes to the individual. So we do address it, but we could be more clear about making sure that, you know, it's prominent within that written privacy summary, or that the written privacy summary is, you know, made more prominent, or something on the website so that the individual sees it.
Yeah, the list that you're remembering, David, I think is related to if you're asking the individual to give authorization for another purpose of use, is the minimum amount of things you need to tell them about what you're going to do.
Yeah, that's what I was remembering. You're right.
Yep. Noam and Mark, and then Mark. So Noam, you're up.
Yeah, just real quick, what this whole section on meaningful use doesn't address or comment on, and it may have to do with this second half of this sentence. My reading of TESCA is that this meaningful choice is a sort of all or nothing from the patient's standpoint, right? It's not selective granular consent for this data, not that data. So we haven't really talked about whether we support that sort of all or nothing aspect of this. And my concern is that a patient will make a meaningful choice not to share data, and an unintended consequence would be that their public health data, where they're permitted to make such a choice, in some states you can, some you can't, would then also be restricted, and the patient might not even realize it.
Fair concern. So let's pause for a moment because we're coming up on public comment. Mark, noting that you're in. Mark, do you have a quick comment that you want to get in, or can I come back to you after public comment?
Either way.
Why don't you go?
So just channeling what Arian was saying earlier about the work of the privacy and security Tiger team, there was, I've been searching for the definition. They did talk, there's good language, I think, out there about what this recommendation is trying to do, and I'm looking for it so I can drop it into the chat box.
I think she circulated the recommendations from the Tiger team in an email a couple of days ago, but
Oh, you are right.
No.
I will look there.
So we're going to go to public comment, and I'm just going to note for the ONC team that I suddenly lost connection to the view, so I'm going to try and get back connected during public comment.
That's okay. John, we'll go to public comment. So, operator, can we open the line?
If you would like to make a public comment, please press star 1 on your telephone keypad. A confirmation tone will indicate your line is in the queue. You may press star 2 if you would like to remove your comment from the queue. For participants using speaker equipment, it may be necessary to pick up your handset before pressing the star keys.
Thank you. And do we have any comments in the queue?
Our first comment comes from Mary Savickix with Chime. Please proceed with your comment.
Hi, thanks everyone. I joined the call late, but I did want to make one comment surrounding the feedback we've been receiving from our members. We largely represent CIOs, CMIOs, and others in the C-suite who purchase and deploy the technology. And one of the concerns that they have with this, and acknowledging all the hard work that's gone into this by the committee and by ONC, is how to manage a HIPAA standard with the new TEFCA standard. So there seem to be a lot of complexities and things that need to be ironed out. A lot of discussion around consent. We have a lot of questions about how that would be managed. And one of the things that we're going to recommend in our comment letter on Monday is that there be some sort of crosswalk between how this will interplay with other existing rules. So thank you for the opportunity to comment.
Thank you. And I actually think we have a recommendation that comes pretty close to saying we agree. I believe that was based on comments that we got on the last call. So I think thank you for your input. And I think we're making a recommendation that supports what you just said.
Yeah, we totally appreciate that. Thank you so much.
Sure.
Operator, do we have any other comments?
There are no further comments at this time.
Okay. John, I'll let you know if any others come through.
Thank you. In the meantime, I will note that I cannot connect, but I'm falling back to good old, I got my file in front of me. So if we can push through the discussion of recommendation 11A and B, we will have met our compromise target for the day. So 11A was that ONC should clarify the meaning of perspective as it relates to the definition of meaningful choice and how such choice would be implemented and enforced. We had a lively debate, and now trying to channel Mark's suggestion that, great, you're asking for clarification, but how should it be? I think we started thinking through, okay, what does it mean if you say that my data shouldn't be used in the future, but the data that you've transacted in the past can be used? The implementation of that seemed to be a little unclear, and it wasn't unclear what ONC intended to have happen, and therefore it was difficult to extrapolate whether that was technologically easy, hard, or impossible. Are there comments? Because I cannot see raised hands anymore.
David, I've got one. Surprise.
Okay, you're my best customer. Keep going.
Yeah. Well, I think, a proposed clarification might be, to Mark's request, that we not just ask for clarification, but we actually make a proposal, is that they clarify that this can only apply to prospective flow of information through entities governed by the contract they have with TEF. It cannot legally apply to data that's already been collected because that the authority of the TEF doesn't apply to that, as well as, of course, to the clinical difficulty of unseeing something in an electronic medical record. So I would say propose that we clarify that it's prospective only. It's not equivalent to right to be forgotten because there's no authority to do that, I don't think.
And that's how I've read this all along. So I'm not sure what clarification, frankly, is really necessary.
Does anybody remember, there was some, yeah, no, I'm trying to help you. There is, I remember some specific examples of if I've got data that was transacted on this patient before they exercise meaningful choice, I guess maybe is there any lack of clarity around that means that I can use their data for anything that I it's not limited to. There was some issue of have I opted out of only exchange purposes, or can I use it for anything that's allowed in the future uses? I'm just trying to prompt ping people's brains. I'm not trying to make a problem where there isn't one.
Someone raised the question about the fact that it wasn't clear. So I think I agree with Noam that it is fairly clear, but maybe we can just say make it more clear that it's a prospective.
And it's
with respect to flow.
I think
Zoe?
What wasn't, but maybe with the comment that was confusing about the meaning perspectives, was more about how it's going to be implemented.
Anyone recall an example? Because I know there were some good examples raised where I kind of went, yeah, wow, that's going to be hard. And those are not coming back to mind today.
Well, this is Mark.
Go ahead, Mark.
I've been doing some research on something else for this, and so I'm not sure I picked up on the conversation just before. I may have been the one that put this in, and there was a concern on my part that yes, you cannot delete information from a record once it's put in, but the language that said you could continue to use it and disclose it, that was what was giving me heartburn then and now, and I. Don't think folks should be able to continue to use and disclose information once the choice has been made.
Okay, so there isn't a lack of clarity, because I think you're saying there should be a right to be forgotten. Is that what that translates?
Forgotten, to? Yes. Not to. I wasn't going so far as to say delete all the information from the prior records, because that's not the practice.
You're saying, okay, so it's not right to be forgotten. It's you're saying the request to
stop using it, stop disclosing it.
But you don't have to stop having it.
Correct, because it's already a part of your business records.
Okay, so
I don't know how you stop using something that you have in your record. I think that would be quite a legal challenge to a provider to not act on something that's in his record, his or her record.
I remember from the prior call that was, I believe, ONC's rationale was they were trying to make this meaningful choice implementable.
Hey, right, because then it becomes a provenance problem where, right, you have to sort of stick where everything came from and then filter it based on those meaningful choices.
Very much. That's the technical approach, which is not well supported today, unfortunately.
Okay, so there's a good clarification to recommendation A. Let me see if I can bring this in under the wire on recommendation B. It was just an issue that meaningful choice should be revocable. Individuals should have the ability to change their meaningful choice preferences at any time. However, there was some lack of clarity on whether such changes should apply retrospectively or prospectively. I think we can probably mush these two together because it's the same question. It's just whether because it's going to get complicated if an individual turns their access off and then back on again, or their permission to use their data on and back off again, or the other way. It's going to get confusing, but we're saying that they should have that right. It's just going to, it's the same issue.
Right, but that's not a lack of clarity. That's just disagreement. I mean, right? I mean, I don't. For me, there isn't a lack of clarity. Some folks are just disagreeing. There's a difference.
No,
right?
I agree. So recommendation 11, A and B should be. I'm noting this for whoever's taking notes. Should probably be written to not be requesting clarification. It should be to point out that. We understand that the and this may be one where we have disagreement, that on the one hand, we understand the intent of ONC is saying the prospective use is constrained, but the use of data retrospectively shared can be continued to be used, that there's some who don't think that's a good idea, and acknowledging that we do still agree that meaningful choice should be revocable, and the draft says that it is, I believe.
Yeah, that's what choice implies.
Okay, so with that, we are a little bit past time. Zoe, Lauren, is that a good stopping point?
Yeah, it works from my perspective. Zoe, do you have anything else before we wrap up?
No.
Okay.
I guess process-wise, John, do we want folks to send feedback over the weekend and then we can attempt to incorporate it on Monday? Or
to whom would they send it? And the second half of that question is, should we constrain that just to make the task doable to say if you have input on, this is probably terrible, recommendations 12 through 18, send us feedback, or is that exactly what we shouldn't try to do?
I would say my recommendation would be for now to limit the feedback to recommendations 1 through 11. And
okay. You
try as hard as possible if you do like to do redline, like inline edits, that can be easily accepted just to make life easier. And then I'll offer that, we can either use the Google Doc or people can just send me their feedback directly and I can, you know, reconcile it all.
Are would we be reacting to the current draft in front of us or to what is going to reflect today's discussion?
What's going to reflect today's discussion? So we'll edit this draft and we'll do a redline comparison so you have a redline copy and a clean copy.
So we're asking that we're giving the task force the opportunity to react to the next version, which will be sent out. And Zoe, I believe you're committing to midnight Friday, or what are we committing to?
Yeah, it's end of day Friday.
Okay. And then just for simplicity's sake, I'm going to say task force members, send your any edits using track changes to Zoe and copy Arianne and myself so we can see what's going on.
Sounds good.
Okay. Thank you. Good catch, Zoe. All right. With that, apologize for going over, and thanks for everybody. And we'll do our best to present this work at the HITECH meeting.
Thanks so much. Bye.
Good luck.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Bye.